And quickly, that this is just before the Ellie Oldroyd interview. I'm with Dom here, and we just want to say a quick thank you to URN. We've just had the awards night last night. Both myself and Dom are feeling a bit worse for wear after the night, and it was great fun. We were lucky enough to win Best Feature for the URN Super Over to all our guests, which we were hugely excited about, and got bronze in the social media and in Best Podcast. So huge thank you to all of URN, and I mean James in particular has been so helpful.
And we've just done this interview with Ellie. It's a great interview, so do enjoy it. We won't keep you for long. Like Toby just said, thanks to everyone who gave us those awards. We really do appreciate it. This is being our first year, and we've loved every minute of it, it's fair to say. And I've only met Toby once, but we've had a great laugh. And look at us now, we're going to cricket in the summer, both driving all the way back to Nottingham. So it's really been a true delight to have, and we've been so lucky. If you guys have any ideas of what you want to see us do, there's a lot of things in the bag. Toby briefly talks about it in the outro, but I'll just say, Ellie Oldroyd, what a lovely human being. It is a delight to talk to her. You can just tell probably at the start how sort of starstruck we are, and it is just a great excuse. This is given as an excuse to talk to people I've always wanted to talk to, but and we get to pretend like it's work, and this was absolutely sensational. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy the show. Me and Toby will be with you, I'm going to say Tuesday. We'll probably get Tuesday. There might be a poll out. But yeah, thanks again. Cheers. And welcome to a royal episode of Sticky Wickets. Toby and I are here, but we're joined by the First Lady of Fighting Talk, the Queen of Tailenders, and the God of BBC Sports Coverage. Please be upstanding for Eleanor Oldroyd. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm overwhelmed and delighted and very, very happy to be with you. And I'm now going to give you a regal wave as well, just to prove it.
So good to have you here. Me and Dom are so excited to have you on, Ellie. It feels quite weird talking to a voice that we've heard, like some of our listeners have, just on the radio, on podcasts, on everything, basically. And it kind of feels a bit weird, almost talking to an old friend. Just the voice has been so heard so often. But to start with, as a tradition on the podcast, we get all our guests to take part in our award-winning URN Super Over. It's a series of quick-fire questions for all our guests to answer. So you ready, Ellie?
I am more than ready.
Perfect. So first question, which athlete from any other sport would you like to see play cricket?
I think I would like to have seen Thierry Henry play cricket. He was one of my all-time favourite Arsenal players. And you just think he was so naturally talented. He could do anything with a ball. So who's to say he couldn't do anything with a cricket ball or a cricket bat? I'm not quite sure whether I would want him to bat, bowl, or just be, you know, supreme all-rounder.
I think he'd have a va-va-voom about him wherever he played on the cricket pitch.
Absolutely.
A Lord's Test fifer or a Lord's Test 100?
I don't know. You know, yeah, the honours board. I mean, it's so far out of reach for me in any sense whatsoever at any stage in my career, because it was hopeless at sport at school. I think it's going to have to be 100, I reckon. In my imaginary cricketing career, which never existed then I would probably have been a batter rather than a bowler.
Oh, very nice. Number three, what has been your favourite match you've seen live or on TV?
Well, that's a really, really hard one, actually, because I think that if you think of probably the three greatest moments for England cricket fans of the last 20 years. So Ashes win in 2005 at the Oval. I was there. I was extremely drunk. I was not working, in case you ask. Then World Cup final in 2019. Of course, you know, there, working. Couldn't believe it. Could not believe my eyes. Also, Women's World Cup final in 2017, I was there for that as well. Again, drinking, not working. And then Ben Stokes, Headingley 2019, working, not able to take in what was happening, having started the day saying, England haven't got a hope in hell of winning this. And then they did. So I don't know which one of those would, those four would I pick. I think for alcohol levels alone, the 2005 Ashes.
Oh, that's great to know that Eleanor Aldred was on the lash for that 2005 Ashes.
Serious amounts of Australian Chardonnay drunk that afternoon.
I think I might know where this might be going. What are three essentials of a cricket tea?
Three essentials of a cricket tea: scone, jam, cream. And I'm not going to go into the order because, you know, there's enough division in the world at the moment. We don't need more.
Oh, that is amazing. So if you were to walk out to bat for England, what song would you want to walk out to?
I suppose, well, if you kind of go back to the early days of Fighting Talk, when I was, you know, the first lady of Fighting Talk, then it would be Tom Jones' She's a Lady. if that would work, do you think that would work?
I think that would have a great atmosphere at Edgbaston on finals day, strolling out to bat with Tom Jones in the background. I can't think of anything more dramatic. It just...
Absolutely. Holly Stapp going mad.
Yeah. Last question. Would you rather be at a test match at Lord's in the Pavilion or in the Holly Stand for finals day?
I've got to say test match at Lord's in the Pavilion. For a whole range of reasons. You know, it's my special place, I think, actually. There's a point on the spot on the top tier in the Pavilion at Lord's where I've sat on many occasions, and actually it's usually for a county game because, you know, it's a test match. I mean, in recent years I've mostly been working at test matches, but yeah, that would be that is the place where I kind of go and I feel totally at peace with the world, and yeah, sitting there with my headphones in, listening to, if I could work on the test match and also be on the top deck of the Pavilion listening to it on TMS, then I would do that. If I could kind of create an avatar and split myself from one end of the ground to the other, then I would do that. So yeah, no, Lord's Pavilion test match any day of the week.
That's quite a surreal, serene sort of image you've put in all our minds. And it does make you want to be at Lord's so much, especially after the year we've had. Well, we're going to start with the basic question, Ellie. How did you get into cricket?
I think I got into cricket really because I hated it when I was about 13, when I was growing up. I suppose I didn't hate it, but I just didn't get it. That was the thing about it. You know, it was the sort of household, you know, the family that I grew up with were obsessed with sport, you know, all year round. So my dad, my brothers, my mum as well. My mum's a big cricket fan, actually. She used to go to Lord's when she was at school in London, you know, in the 1940s. But sport was on the TV all the time. Some of my earliest memories are of early Olympic games. So, you know, so I think probably this makes me, you'll realize how incredibly old I am when I tell you that I can remember the 1968 Olympic games, just watching it on the TV and just being aware of it. You know, nothing more specific than that. But then I, you know, cricket was the big obsession, was my dad's big obsession. So it was on all the time and I just didn't get what was going on. It's like anything you don't understand. You're a bit scared of it probably, or you just think, I'm blocking this out. I don't want to take this on board. And then I reached the point, I suppose, when I was about 14, when I just thought, I'm not going to get rid of this. This is part of family life. And the best thing to do is to try and find out a bit about it. So I sat down with my dad over a summer of 1976, which was when the West Indies were over here, you know, and it was that unbelievable West Indian team. So, you know, Viv Richards, Clive Lloyd, Michael Holding, Andy Roberts, just ripped England apart. And so I just became pretty obsessed with cricket that year, actually. And from that point onwards, I just kind of flipped from one to the other. So from hating it, not understanding it, to totally being mad about it and putting posters up and making scrapbooks and listening to everything and reading everything I could about the game. So that was a real, you know, real turning point for me. So from that point onwards, really. And that was the stage, I think, where I thought, if I can find somebody who will pay me to watch cricket all day, doesn't matter what it is, you know, I'll go and work as a groundsman. I mean, although there were probably just as few female groundsmen as there were female sports writers at that time, I thought that will be the job for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic to hear. So a lot of people listening are from URN, like Dom and myself, and with many from the sports department looking to go into careers in sports broadcasting and journalism. So how did you get into sports broadcasting, and what tips might you have for some of us at URN looking to go into the field of work?
Well, I when I went to uni, I mean, I was lucky. I went to Cambridge University, and that had a very good sports tradition at the time, or a sports journalism tradition. So I had a student newspaper, which I managed to blag my way onto in my first year, covering hockey actually initially, then in my second year I became sports editor of Stop Press, as it was then, and because I was the editor, I could just choose whatever I wanted to do. So I decided, yeah, forget the hockey, you know, love you boys, but you know, it's got to be cricket all the way from now on. And one of the first proper interview I ever did was with David Gower, who was playing for Leicestershire at the time, just before he became England captain. And you know, he just happened to be at Finners playing the university team, and it poured with rain one day. And so I just went up and sort of said, sorry, Mr. Gower, any chance that I can have a chat with you for our student newspaper? And he said yes. And he was, of course, lovely and charming, as he still is. And so that was my way in, really. So I did lots and lots of writing. Broadcasting wasn't really on the, you know, on my radar at that stage, because there wasn't really a proper university station, because, you know, in the days before the internet, you had to have obviously a broadcasting license. And there wasn't such a, you know, and Cambridge is too big, actually. It's just, that's the problem. There's colleges are all spread out all over the place. A friend of mine had a program. So I went on his program one day, and that was the first time I ever sat in front of a microphone, probably. But then when I graduated, couldn't get a job working in written press, you know, and eventually went and did work experience at my local radio station in Worcester. And my editor at the time, you know, I went to him and said, I want to do cricket. And he said, yeah, of course, fine, no problem. So it was actually as easy as that. but I was very lucky, because, you know, he didn't think there was anything at all weird in a woman doing sports journalism or cricket. So thank you to him. And that was it. So started off reporting on county championship, you know, one day games at New Road in Worcester, which is one of the most beautiful spots in the country to watch cricket.
Wow, fantastic. I know me and Dom both want to almost follow in those footsteps and try and get on the shows like you have.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of luck. You know, there is definitely luck in it. You know, there's determination. There is being kind of quite focused and single-minded about it, but there's also that element of being in the right place at the right time. So yeah. But you've got to kind of believe in yourself. You've got to back yourself quite a lot, and you know, and do what you're doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's good to hear that we're hopefully on the right route. You've been a commentator on Test Match Special, a skill many people think they can do, but to do it to a high standard is incredibly difficult. How difficult is it to commentate, and how much preparation do you need to do before the matches?
I kind of want to correct you slightly, Toby, because commentary is something that I've not done a great deal of, actually, on TMS. I've done quite a lot of reporting, I've done interviewing, and inevitably when I'm doing the update, you know, the update role on Radio 5 Live, then there's some commentary elements in that. But to sit down and, you know, and the cricket social as well, which I've done recently as well. So again, there's little bits of commentary in there. But I mean, I have huge admiration for people like Ali Mitchell and Isha Guha, and you know, Ebony Rainford-Brent, who have come into who are the new generation, if you like, of, or Ali kind of crosses over from there, you know, she's a slightly middle generation, but she's you know, a few years younger than me. Because when I was started out as a reporter, commentary seemed like such, I mean, not a taboo thing, that's not the right thing to say, but it just felt like something that women were really judged on, you know, that people would accept a woman presenter or a woman reporter, but there was this idea that female voices get too high in commentary, that they become squeaky, and that's uncomfortable to listen to. So the first women who started out, so people like Ali and Jackie Oatley on football, got it in the neck. I mean, there's no two ways about it. They were really badly trolled, because the criticism wasn't fair, but they were trolled for being women daring to commentate. So I think at the time that I was starting out, commentary seemed a scary thing. And now it's sort of reached the stage where more women do it. And so actually, and in fact, I commentated on ice hockey when I was in local radio, which is actually much harder to commentate on, I think, probably than cricket, because it goes so fast. And I've done bits of TV commentary as well at the Olympics. But cricket commentary is something that I think the standard is so high, and you've got to be so brilliant at it. It's something that I'm still a little bit nervous of doing, because I don't want to mess up, you know. And we all get scared of messing up at different times, and none of us should be embarrassed about messing up. But certainly in the early stages of my career, and you know, until now, actually, you know, even now, it's fine to be a woman broadcaster or journalist, but if you mess up, if you make a mistake, if you ask difficult questions, if you say something that might be seen as something that could be criticized, thinking of, you know, Alex Hartley and Rory Burns, you know, people leap down your throat. People just judge women in a different way, even now. And so, I mean, that's kind of quite a slightly deep and off tangent answer to the question that you asked, Toby, but I think that sort of explains really why it still feels like, you know, a more welcoming place for women, but still it's not a level playing field at the moment.
And I think there's been a lot of conversations about men in society in the past 2 days with the horrific news. And I think it is men's duty almost now to be better. You can't just not be the problem. You've got to help solve the problem. And that goes even into cricket, whether that be people criticising women's cricket. We've all seen it on the BBC where in the comments, people will be saying, oh, I don't want to watch this, the standard's too low. I think a lot of men who like cricket have got to go, no, this is very high standard cricket. I'd like to see you face Elise Perry. Mm. I'd like to see you take catches like Sarah Taylor, because that is the pinnacle of sport. Like, I've said this so many times. The Sarah Taylor catch is the greatest catch of all time in any sport, due to the reaction time, due to the difficulty, due to every variable that goes into that pitch. And to see it not get quite the recognition the Odell Beckham catch gets, but maybe that's because of the American media and all that. But it's so sad to see. And we've got an interview coming out with the University of Nottingham ladies cricket team where we discuss matters like this. And me and Toby will hopefully keep talking about women's cricket, because it's getting to a state where it is becoming men's and women's cricket are so equal in coverage. And yes, it's not there at the moment, but in a few years, I genuinely believe it will happen. And it's good to hear, Ellie, you talking about it from such a knowledgeable standpoint, and we really do appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I think you make a really good point, actually, and the progress that women's cricket and women's sport in general has made has been massive from, you know, in the last 10 years, you know, even the last 5 years, really. And it's not at that stage yet, but the reaction, it was very, very interesting. So, you know, so the Alex Hartley, Rory Burns, I'm not even going to call it a spat on Twitter, and, you know, and I can, you know, I understand, you know, Alex said herself that it was a clumsy tweet, and I'm sure that they will have dealt with it between them, but it was that bringing down of the wrath of men's cricket Twitter on Alex's head that was so difficult to see. And what is so powerful, actually, is what, you know, when you talk about what you're doing, you know, the fact that actually you can, Elise Perry and Meg Lanning and Sarah Taylor and, you know, Tammy Beaumont are all household names. If you're a cricket fan, you should know who these people are. And one of my favourite podcasts, I mean, clearly, hopefully we'll talk about tail enders at some point, because I know you're big fans. But one of my other favourite podcasts is the Final Word podcast with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins. And one of the things that's so powerful about that is that they spent a lot of time talking about women's cricket, you know, and obviously, I mean, they're both Aussies the Australian women's team has been supreme for many, many years, but for them, there is no difference, you know, that they will talk about women's tours and the state of women's cricket and heroic performances by female cricketers in exactly the same way as they do the men's game. And one of the great moments for me, you mentioned Sarah Taylor, was when Adam Gilchrist said that she was the best wicketkeeper in the world. Bar none, you know, not best female wicketkeeper, best wicketkeeper in the world. And you know, you just need to look at some of her great stumpings and you think, I mean, my goodness me, that woman had quick hands. It's a shame that her career, you know, finished when it did, but she's an amazing, amazing role model.
Yeah, she really is an amazing role model for just wicketkeepers, but also for men and women growing up who want to go into cricket due to the amount of work she's had to do. And it's such a shame she didn't get this post 2017 World Cup enjoyment of women's cricket, notoriety of women's cricket. And that I'd say there's a lot of women like Rachel Hayhoe Flint. She didn't quite get that recognition she deserves, and she had the county championship named after her last year. And it's getting there, but we've got to do a lot of strides towards equality, it's fair to say.
DJ! This is URN University Radio Nottingham.
Now, moving on to a bit of a lighter topic. You were in Old Trafford and the Rose Bowl on lockdown this summer. Being stuck with Toughers and Aggers for 24-7, was that like a strange cricketing holiday or was that a madhouse? I was so interested to know because I heard stories of takeaway nights. I heard stories of all sorts of hijinks. And I would really like to know, what was it like in there?
Well, my time in the bubble was made considerably easier by the fact that I didn't have a room next door to Aggers. So I didn't have to put up with his terrible banjo playing at all hours. He drove people up the wall with his blooming banjo. And then Henry Moran, you know, who I love dearly, suggested to him that actually what he needed was an amplifier. So Aggers got an amp for his banjolele. And at that point, I think, you know, I'm amazed that he did not get thrown out of the bubble at that point, because that was just deeply shocking and awful. No, it was fun. I mean, it was, you know, it was stressful at times. It was weird. I mean, weird beyond belief, because you were obviously having social distancing. So, you know, even though we were working together, so I was in the Five Live box with Henry a lot of the time, but at a distance. So, you know, so he was at one back at the back of the box. I was at the front of the box. In the TMS box itself for the commentary, they had Perspex screens set up in between between the different commentary positions. We were being tested once a week. And that's not fun for anybody, as you know. And we were having to live really quite a restricted life at the time when things were relaxing during the summer. We were still stuck in those very constricted bubbles. But I mean, honestly, it was so worth it, because the chance to watch real life cricket and really good quality cricket as well. You know, we saw some amazing moments, you know, like Stuart Broad's 500th wicket and Jimmy's 600th, and that amazing partnership, do you remember, with Joss Butler and Chris Wokes as well at Old Trafford. That was absolutely fantastic. And it was just, you know, having spent so many months of broadcasting from home, it was brilliant to be actually in a commentary box watching real life sport in front of your eyes. So I wouldn't have swapped it for anything. And I think hopefully this summer, I've just been talking about it in the last couple of days, actually. The plan is that we'll have pretty much a normal summer when it comes to games happening. Everything crossed, crowds in as well. And that's the thing that we missed most of all, I think. You know, you remember when Stokesy and Joss opened the batting, it was against West Indies. I can't remember if it was against West Indies or Pakistan but it was at Old Trafford. And you just could just imagine the roar of the crowd, and the point would have been going mad, and the temporary stand would have been full of people making, you know, beer snakes and just, it's just, I mean, when you talk about the Hollies stand erupting on finals day, that just sends a tingle down my spine, because, you know, however much we love watching cricket, it's not the same without the fans in. So it was fun. Apart from Aga's terrible banjo playing, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's good to hear that hopefully in the next coming year things will become more normal. And I know myself and Dom, we have tickets for the second day of the test match at Trent Bridge.
Brilliant. I'll see you there.
Yeah. And so hopefully we'll be able to go and it will be back to the way that cricket should be, with 20,000 fans all watching on. And we can see the greatest moments live, hopefully. So you've travelled the world, broadcasting and presenting. And so what are some of the best places you've had the pleasure of visiting? There have been any nightmares as well, perhaps, which aren't as good?
Well, it won't surprise you to hear that my best trip was for the Ashes in 2017-18, because I'd wanted to go to an overseas Ashes for so long, you know, my whole life. And I'd wanted to go to the Adelaide Oval my whole life as well. You know, it was one of my absolute bucket list places. So that was incredible, and I pinch myself every day. And I only did the first two tests, so when I came back, you know, and I had to fly back from Adelaide after two test matches, I was so miserable and depressed, you know, and leaving beautiful sunny South Australia and flying back to snow in December in London was just grim. But apart from that, I mean, the Olympics has been my big thing, and I've done every Summer Olympics since 1992 now, and hopefully we're working on Tokyo if it goes ahead, although whether there or here, we're really not sure at the moment. There's lots still up for discussion. But the, you know, the best times have been, I mean, every Olympics has had its great moments. And Sydney, of course, was one of my favourites. London, I absolutely loved. So, you know, so it was my favourite Olympics, even though it was my home city. And probably because it was in my home city, because I knew how much it was going to mean to people and how people were going to engage and fall in love with watching taekwondo or weightlifting or water polo or random sports they knew nothing about. But every Olympics, even the ones which have been hard work, and we haven't won any medals. So it's hard. It's actually, you know, for your generation, probably hard. You won't remember this, but in Atlanta in 1996, we won one gold medal. Team GB won one gold medal. And so day after day after day, you'd be reporting on glorious British failure. And then suddenly it all turned around with the national lottery. And so from 2000 onwards, and particularly, you know, 2004 and moving on, and more success year after year. So there have been amazing moments. But every single Olympics, you get tired, you know, because it's quite a long haul. It's 3 weeks somewhere overseas. Everyone gets a bit mentally stressed. There's always a point where somebody's in tears, you know, and it's quite often me. I got a really, really bad throat infection in Rio in 2016 and had to take myself off air in the middle of a program. So I was in the Olympic Park, just kind of broadcasting away about the shooting, and you've got swimming heats this morning, and later on it's the cycling. And then all of a sudden I couldn't speak. And so I had to hand the radio microphone over to Conor McNamara, who was with us in the park. And I'd said, look, Conor, you're going to have to carry on. And then I went and had to, you know, I mean, in a kind of strange echo of what a lot of us have been through this year, I then had to self-isolate in my room for all of 2 days. And that felt hard. But yeah, that was the only way I could get back on air, was just by completely resting my voice. But it's a huge privilege. I mean, honestly, how lucky have I been?
You must be so excited for Tokyo 2021. I know the synchronized swimmers who will be going, Kate and Izzy. Ellie, I've got to say, they're the two loveliest girls in the world. You must interview them. They're so nice. I went to school with both of them, and they're just so nice to be around. And I really hope they get the recognition they deserve. They've been working really hard for it, and best of luck to them. And you've sort of alluded to it here. You've met greats of seemingly every sport in the world. Who's been the best player to interview in any sport? And who's been maybe, I'm not going to say the worst, but who has given you the most trouble interviewing? Who's made it most difficult for you?
Well, I can't possibly tell you that, can I, Dom? Really, you know, I wouldn't be as impolite. It's much easier to talk about people I've loved interviewing. I mean, most of the cricketers I've met and interviewed, I've enjoyed speaking to and got something special out of meeting them. And there's a certain amount of, well, I mean, less so now, because you don't take it for granted exactly, but you become more relaxed. So when on Test Match Special, I was working with Viv Richards, that was a huge pinch yourself moment, because he is as charismatic as you would imagine he would be. I've always loved interviewing Denise Lewis. So we talk about great Olympic moments. I was in the Olympic Stadium in 2000 when she won her gold medal. So she is one of my total heroes. I interviewed, going back to the Olympics as well, 1992, when Linford Christie won his gold medal in the 100 metres. You know, you just think, well, that night, in Olympic terms, he is the most famous man on the planet, because it's the big event, obviously, 100 metres. So that was amazing and memorable. But do you know, it's funny, actually, because there are some people who are so interesting to interview. So, I mean, Kevin Peterson, everyone has a view on Kevin Peterson. Sat down with him not a few years ago, actually, now. He wrote a book about batting, and interviewing him about batting was incredible. You learn so much. He's such a big thinker on the game. And, you know, I say he is a divisive character, but actually, talking to KP, you just thought, wow, actually, what a bright, passionate bloke he is. But I always think that with KP, that if he played an individual sport rather than a team sport, he would have been one of the greatest sporting heroes we've ever had in this country. because you wouldn't have had to worry about pesky teammates and and, you know, being fitting into a unit like that. But if he'd been a golfer, say, then actually I think he would have had a potentially a much longer career.
Yeah, whenever I think of KP, the first thing of him talking about cricket comes to mind is he did an interview with Sky Sports talking about batting as well. And he always sort of says, oh, you've got to get your head towards the ball, and came up with all of these sort of really sort of niche points that I'd never thought about before. And the second he says them, it seems so obvious, but just the way that he words it and comes up with it is so impressive, really.
Mm, yeah. I love Jimmy Anderson as well, of course, but I mean, everyone loves Jimmy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't need to say any more than that, do I really? You know, but we love you, Jimmy.
Yeah. Now, Ellie, on to a really important question. This one, this is huge. Which ground has the best food for commentators?
Edgbaston. And I could say Lords, because Lords look after you very well as well. People, before I kind of got back into doing cricket as a regular thing, because I had a few years away doing lots of Olympic things and other sports and not really doing cricket very much. But when I got back on the circuit a few years ago, people said, oh, Edgbaston just has the best buffet in the world. I mean, you know, you start the day. I mean, honestly, if an Edgbaston test match, I think I put on about a stone in weight every time I do it, because you start off with the bacon brioche in the morning, and you can, but that's not the only thing. So you could have a bacon brioche, and you could have pastries, and you can have fruit salad, and you can have a smoothie. You know, you could, so you can eat all your calories for the day at breakfast. But then of course lunch comes around, and there's a curry buffet, and there's a roast, and there's salads. And then you haven't recovered from breakfast by the time you have lunch. And so then you've got the 2 hours afternoon session where you probably had a little snooze if you've had the chance to do that. Oh, and there's the sweets dispenser as well. So if you feel hungry for any reason, you nip downstairs and you get yourself a handful of sweets. And then of course there's the tea interval. And so you then got your scones, you've then got your sandwiches, you know, and at the close of play, there's pies.
Oh,
so there's a lot of food at Edgbaston.
We're doing this, listener, at lunchtime. And me and Toby, if I'd say, we both look a bit tired. And what Ellie has just done there is almost like J.K. Rowling when she like wrote all those books about how the feast would appear. It's not fair. I'm going to be honest. That was not needed. We just wanted a straight answer. And you've made us feel so hungry now.
Well, I know. I mean, the Edgbaston buffet is like the Hogwarts feast. You're quite right. It is exactly like that. It just, food just keeps on coming. And, you know, and you have to have a will of steel to stop yourself just stuffing your face and then stuffing your pockets with pies at the close of play as well. Because then, if I'm staying in a hotel in the evening and you then go out for dinner in the evening and go for a curry. Oh, I do feel slightly sick now I'm saying this. But
Oh, we're going to have to move away from food because, for my sake, really, because I'm feeling quite peckish and we're still quite interested here. You've, like you said there, you've gone to Olympics and you host live shows like Inside Track, and you're sort of all over major sporting stories. How difficult is it? I've always loved this about great hosts like Des Lynam and Mark Chapman and Dan Walker. They're so adaptable, and yourself, obviously, to all manner of sports, whether that be rugby league, whether that be cricket. And you've hosted the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, and you have to talk about the Swedish luge team. And then in a few weeks' time, you have to talk about the West Indies batting problems. How difficult is that? And how much preparation goes into just one show, maybe?
Mm. Well, a lot of it is experience and the years you've spent covering things. So, you know, so I've done, I kind of lost track now, seven Summer Olympics and four Winter Olympics. So if you've done judo, you know, so I did judo in my first Olympics. So you kind of know roughly how it works, and then you go back and you get your current knowledge, and if there's been any rule changes in between. And I mean, there's a big difference between covering football, rugby, cricket, you know, the major sports, and then covering the Olympic sports, because with football, you know, rugby, cricket, racing, you're always kind of conscious that there are people out there who know way more than you do. So, you know, I kind of know quite a lot about cricket now, but I'm just conscious that there are an awful lot of people who are huge, huge cricket badgers and are ready to pull me up on any mistakes I make. In some ways, it's almost easier to go and cover an Olympic sport because you are you know, you maybe start with a tiny amount of knowledge. So, you know, sort of imagine a very small amount of knowledge. And you know that there are people out there who've got a massive amount of knowledge, but then most people who are going to be listening during the Olympics to Radio 5 Live also have that tiny amount of knowledge. So if you can reach the point by the time the games start when you've got that much knowledge, you know, kind of some medium amount, then you're hopefully not going to leave the people behind who've got that tiny amount of knowledge. You're going to make it accessible to them, but you're also not going to massively piss off the people who have a huge amount of knowledge, you know. So that will, you fall somewhere in the middle. So you do your prep. You have to do your prep. You know, you don't want to be exposed. You know, we have producers as well who are, you know, at 5 Live, we're very lucky. We've got brilliant producers who will do research and will help you out and make sure that you're properly briefed beforehand. And actually also when it comes to the Olympics, there's a team of researchers who work for BBC Sport who do this thing every year called the Bible. And the Bible has a section on each sport, and in that is the history of that sport. So the history of judo, for example, the key things that you should know, the key facts you should know about the sport, you know, the rules of the game, the world picture, you know, who's good that year, and a Team GB, from a Team GB point of view, you know, who the leading contenders are. So yeah, I mean, I could pretend that it's all me, but it's an awful lot of people who do an awful lot of hard work all the time to make sure that we're well briefed.
The Bible sounds like a great book. And is there any chance that could maybe be published? Because that would do so well, like in the years of Olympics, when everyone's trying to pretend like they know what's going on, and the common man pretends like he understands water polo. Has that ever been thought about being published?
I think probably not, because there are amazing authors who've written books like that. There's always a book that comes out every year, which is the, you know, your ultimate guide to the Olympics for that particular year. The aim is to try and just be that little bit ahead of the audience. I've heard teachers say this as well, that, you know, that the curriculum changes quite a lot. So if you can just be one step ahead of your pupils, then you're probably going to do all right. I love it, and you're learning so much all the time. Let's say, you know, I mean, I've been watching cricket for, what did I say, 45 years, and there's still so much out there that I don't know, and so much that I want to learn about the game. And every time I go and watch a game of cricket, I think, wow, I didn't know that, and right, you know, make a mental note of that. And it's one of the things that I love about it, why it's the best sport for me, is because it's there are so many layers to it and so many levels that you can appreciate it on as well. So you know, and it can seem daunting, but actually I don't think it is daunting, really, if you can just appreciate the pleasure of watching, I don't know, Carlos Brathwaite walloping sixes off Ben Stokes, you know, or Ben Stokes walloping sixes off Pat Cummins. Yeah, then that's a visceral way of appreciating it. It doesn't have to be complicated.
Yeah, you really put it well there. We've talked about how you've been to so many different events, so many different standards, and to so many different countries. Out of all the stadiums in the world, what had the best atmosphere?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, lots of stadiums have different atmospheres on different days. And I think the atmosphere I just kind of close my eyes now and I'm transported back to Lourdes on World Cup final day in 2019. And just that hum and buzz, it was a noise like I'd never heard at Lourdes before. Just this disbelief and this just kind of people not saying, what are we witnessing? You know, what is a super over? I have no idea what's about to happen now. And actually it was a similar thing as well for the Women's World Cup final in 2017, because that was a different noise, because they, you know, threw it open to a lot of young, I was going to say young girls, but young kids generally. So there was this slightly more high-pitched buzz of excitement and you know, that moment when, you know, Anya Shrubsole takes that final wicket and everything goes totally bonkers. But also that the Headingley final day as well, or the Headingley fourth day in 2019. So I mean, these are all kind of quite recent examples. That they were just unforgettable, you know, hairs on the back of your neck standing up moments, because and I think you should always also, and the great danger as well in sports broadcasting is you have your headphones on the whole time. And to be able to, so the noise is muffled. And actually, I remember going to the Millennium Stadium, Principality Stadium now in Cardiff, for Six Nations games with the roof on, and Wales and Ireland battling it out for the Grand Slam, and thinking I've just got to and being on pitch side and having to take my headphones off and listening to the unbelievable noise that stadium makes when it's completely rocking and the roof is on. So, you know, that's just a few examples of amazing noise and feeling, wow, you know, this is the best job in the world.
Yeah, on the topic of the Women's World Cup final, I think my favourite fact I've seen around that is that it's the most cups of tea ever sold in, I think, possibly sports match history, like, ever, which I think just shows the different people who went to that match.
Yeah, and the gin bar didn't do quite so well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then so just the final question to finish off, Ellie. If you could relive any day of cricket you've experienced, what day would it be and why?
I keep wanting to go back to 2019, I suppose, because it's so close in the memory, and it's so precious as well, because little did we know what was to come the following year, you know, that we would have that moment of, you know, just sheer joy and love of the game, and that we were going to be deprived of it again for so long. I think because also some of the great moments, you know, so the World Cup final, I think it's going to have to be the World Cup final in 2019, because to be there all day was amazing, but it wasn't particularly enjoyable until Jos Bale ran out Martin Guptill. And, you know, so to watch it, to be there and live through it again and to say, it's all right, it's okay, it's going to be fine. It's all going to be fine in the end. You know, we love Martin Guptill and Jimmy Neesham, but don't worry about it. But just to appreciate just the mind-blowing moment, you know, when Trent Bolt stands on the boundary rope, you know, so actually to enjoy that without the tension involved would be really fantastic. And there's a few days which I've appreciated and you just think, well, actually, if we could just change things very slightly and, you know, make it so, you know, England won the test match in Adelaide where Jimmy bowled brilliantly with the pink ball and Joe Root came so close, and it was just those tiny fine margins that games turn on. But yeah, I know. I should sort of be saying, oh, I'll go back to 1981 and Headingley and, you know, Ian Botham and Bob Willis and, you know, but I wasn't there for that. But yeah, that's, I mean, another epic moment. And yeah, we miss Bob as well. What a great man he was.
Yeah, he really was. I think there's just been so many amazing cricket matches, test matches, ODIs, T20s in the past few years in particular, but in the whole of history as well, that there would be so many different places you could go back and see an unbelievable day's play. And so that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid, guys. That has been a fantastic interview. Ellie, we've enjoyed having you on so much. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure to talk to you guys. Really enjoyed it. And good luck. Good luck with everything.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Yeah, so guys, just a reminder, our Instagram and Twitter, we've got @stickywicket_URN and URN Sticky Wicket. Go and give it a follow. It's actually also award-winning, the URN Awards last night, bronze award in that as well. And we've got so many exciting podcasts to come, so keep an eye out for them. We've got the diversity special with the University of Nottingham ladies team. We've got another episode with the men's team as well coming on. And hopefully Ian Cobain, the Gloucestershire player, is going to be coming on as well. So we've got so much, so many new podcasts coming out, as well as obviously the cricket that will keep coming, the IPL, the current England series in India and all over the world. There's so much still going on. So thank you guys for listening. Go well.
Go well. Cheers.
Cheers.
This is URN. This is URN.